If your restaurant wants to put the best on the table, look for food with the New York State Certified Seal. It's food that is grown right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Arway, and we're here at Roberta's Pizza as usual. And it is a lovely sunny Sunday afternoon here in the winter in Brooklyn. And I am joined by an award-winning food editor, longtime food writer. She's the former editor of CNN's Eatocracy, also the former editor-in-chief of Tasting Table. She's now the senior editor of Food and Drink for Extra Crispy, a new website. If you haven't checked it out, it's all about breakfast. And she has written her first book. It is not about food exactly. However, it does trace some of her career, which I'm very excited to hear more about and chat more with you about that. But it is a wonderfully generous, funny, and poignant memoir about anxiety. So thank you for joining us, Kat Kinsman.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And I apologize in advance if I am sniffling, sneezing, snorfling, all that kind of stuff.
Hey, you can talk in a Pepe Le Pew accent as much as you want. Sorry, I was just recalling a delightful recollection in this book. It's her book is called High Anxiety, A Life with a Bad Case of Nerves. It is a lovely and just very gracious memoir about dealing with anxiety and managing it. But in one section in the beginning, you were calling reciting a school paper or something in grade school, and it all coming out for some reason with a weird accent, like in French.
It was such a ridiculous thing. So we were doing some sort of reading exercise, and I realized, like, okay, you know, I have a sister who's 2 years older than I am, and so I had kind of learned to read and along with her. So I was a little bit ahead of the game, you know, from my peers when we were doing this, and I had to get up in front of a crowd and read.
That's
and I was thinking,
worst.
Oh well, it was funny because people were sort of, you know, doing the usual thing that you do when you start to read and stuttering a little bit. And I thought, like, oh gosh, I don't want to have to stand out. And so I, for some reason, I just started doing it in a Pepe Le Pew accent, thinking it was really funny and fancy and somehow would deter from the fact that, like, wait, she can actually read. What's wrong with her?
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so it was
a
little bit of crazy deflection, but it just sort of put the emphasis off of me for a minute. And I really appreciated that.
That's so funny. I love that, you know, I don't know, busting out a French accent is actually a lot of fun sometimes, and like I never thought of it as like a great vice to deflect from, you know, whatever. I think that, you know, getting in front of your peers in school is a huge test of nerves. I mean, it made me nervous reading that part.
I keep hearing from people that it's sort of triggering some panic attacks in some people, and I do not intend for that to be the net effect, but I really want people to feel like they're understood, and if they are having these panic attacks, they are far from alone.
Yeah. I think that seems like, was that the whole mission of writing this book, was to sort of kind of show unity and compassion for a fellow anxiety. I don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I had written a piece a couple of years ago, a few years ago now, I guess it was three, for CNN.com, where I was working at the time, about my struggles with anxiety, especially over the holidays. And the response to that was so... I had not expected anything. I had felt anxiety is like any mental illness is incredibly isolating, and to put that out in the world and have this response and have all these people saying, "Oh my God, me too," was such a huge driver for it. And I thought, okay, I am a really, really lucky person. You know, I'm a straight, cisgendered, white, married woman with access to healthcare. And a whole lot of people who suffer from these things aren't. Mm-hmm. And I thought, if I start, you know, it's not fun to talk about mental illness, but if not me, who should do this? Mm-hmm. And if I can do anything to normalize it, to normalize the conversation, yeah. and let people know that they are deserving of health and healthcare and good treatment, then yeah, it was my duty to do it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in going through all these memories, it sounds like, do you wish you had like a book like this to sort of read and understand from when you're, I don't know, in sixth grade or something?
I don't know if I would have been open to that or not at the time.
It's a bit much, yeah.
Yes. You know, I'm looking now at sort of the resources that kids have, and it's absolutely incredible. I mean, I'm hearing with this book, a lot of parents are saying, like, while there's some subject matter in there that is not appropriate for children, it makes them able to look at their kid and realize that they have some of these issues going on. It's not fun to, you know, I know this from seeing my parents, not fun to look at your child and think that they have, you know, are dealing with a mental illness, that they're dealing with something really painful. My own parents, you know, they're fantastic, but they wanted to find every single physical reason for what was going on before, you know, entertaining the notion that it might be something that was, you know, mentally wrong.
Sometimes, you know, just hearing person to person, even if it's a book or just, I don't know, a meeting is always, I felt like I was talking to a person reading your book. So it was very comforting.
I'm glad. Yeah. I wanted people to feel like they weren't alone. I keep thinking when I started writing these mental illness essays, and I was lucky enough to have, you know, to be at CNN where they were incredibly supportive of my speaking openly about this. And I was thinking, they're my employer. They're probably not going to fire me for writing this since they commissioned it. That, you know, I was lucky enough to have that support and the kind of audience that they have. I sort of say it was akin to coming out. And then it really felt like all these lights flicking on in the darkness. And all of a sudden, oh, there's one, and there's one, and there's one, and there's one. And suddenly my universe lit up with all of these other people. I felt so much less alone.
That's such an incredible thing, I guess, about being a writer, is that you don't know, you throw things sort of into the world, and you don't know what's going to stick and how much. And it sounds like you hit a nerve that was, you know, very, very, you know, universal. Through writing about this, and, you know, aside from writing about food, you know, it did you feel like you found another purpose?
Absolutely.
Through that?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many fantastic food writers out there, yourself included, and there are a lot of people who are using it as, and I think people have always done this, but increasingly as a lens to talk about something else, you know, personal, societal.
Right.
It's
right.
a really great.
Political.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the people who do the Race and Food podcast, and they're using it as a lens to talk about, you know, representation in the media. There are people who are using it to talk about, you know, all kinds of, you know, just issues all over the spectrum. And I think we're living in a really, really golden age of food writing. You know, people complain like, oh, people are too, you know, obsessed with being foodies and stuff. If you read a little bit deeper and give yourself a little bit more leeway to read other things, you'll find that there's some really smart stuff happening.
Yeah, it's not just about food, too. And I think that's wonderful. You can be writing about something that sounds, or it's personally not so fun. But then, thanks to this incredible community, you find joy and just maybe solace. Let's talk about the wonderful world of food writing for a moment. So you're senior editor at Extra Crispy, super fun, super cool website. You've worked in various roles, but mostly in digital media, in food. And where do you see food media going right now? Now, we're about like 5 or 6 years ago from, I think, an article by Amanda Hesser that was very Gloomsday-esque about what it's like to be a food writer, or should I be a food writer, so forth. And media is changing underneath our feet all the time. How would one, I guess, what do you say to people who are like, how do I get to be you, Kat Kinsman? All right.
First of all, like, why would you want to do that?
Look at what this has done to me.
It's funny. I mean, I think people, you know, I think the conversation is so open to this. You can do everything from, I think, like what the New York Times is doing is really tremendous, getting more and more people to cook and talk about cooking and really reclaiming you know, actual cooking at home, I think it's a really fantastic and beautiful thing. Epicurious does a great, great job of that, Food 52. And I think, especially with this upcoming administration, that food is going to be even more politicized than it ever has been before. And I, you know, I consider, I always sort of say Extra Crispy is a little bit of a Trojan horse, because you hear it, it sounds hilarious on the surface. Oh, it's a website all about breakfast and brunch. And you think like, okay, how far you can, you know, it sounds kind of silly. I remember the day we launched, people were like, you know, what the heck is going on? Is this, you know, this just seems kind of ridiculous and trend driven and stuff. The great thing about Extra Crispy, it's the brainchild of this fantastic, my boss, Meredith Turritz, who works for The Foundry, which is the a digital part of Time Inc. And she was kind of looking around to see what wasn't really covered yet. And, you know, breakfast was this interesting kind of white space for that. People were, you know, breakfast was definitely a, you know, cultural obsession, but people weren't writing about it a whole lot. And she assembled this team of people who I can't believe I get to work alongside every day. They're just, it's just like the Transformer, like Voltron of, you know, smart people. Somebody comes from a political think tank. You know, people come from, you know, cultural writing background. And sort of with her and our site director, Ryan Grimm, they assembled this team where we use it as a lens to talk about everything from, you know, hunger to club kids to, you know, the upcoming election. And we realized a really, you know, it's a really great way to talk about absolutely anything we want to, but, you know, so long as it has a breakfast peg and nobody's stopping us, right. And we're only getting encouragement, which is fantastic.
I like to say when, you know, people say, food writing, they always think of restaurant reviewing, and that is not Extra Crispy. That is not so much of what is out there at all.
No, and we're using it. I mean, one of my favorite things is we use it. We have sort of actively put out, you know, welcome that to, you know, writers of all different backgrounds, you know, writers of color all over the, you know, the gender spectrum and stuff, to really tell their stories and really, you know, give that kind of representation. Yeah. And I'm really, you know, happy with how that's been going and the reception it's been given. And, you know, the more of that we do, the more people, you know, come and read what we have to do and contribute to it as well.
I think it's a really cool scope, and it lends itself to so many deep dives into ingredients, for instance, and also cultures, because like food, breakfast is universal. It's not just... although the topic of brunch in Manhattan is endlessly, lends itself to many debates.
And here's a fun thing. Donald Trump doesn't eat breakfast. He doesn't like breakfast. He doesn't eat breakfast. He doesn't drink coffee. He was spotted apparently somewhere drinking coffee recently. But the first piece I wrote actually for Extra Crispy was before I was a staff writer there. And they were just getting in freelance pieces. And I was just having such a ball writing this. But I found that like he doesn't care about breakfast.
Wow. He also doesn't drink, too.
He does not drink.
No fun.
He just, you know, likes to be seen eating, what is it, taco bowls and Big Macs or something. But I think also, you know, it's just a thing. I mean, breakfast is... it's such a funny sort of tabula rasa for the day. You can decide, you know, figure out how your day is going to go by, you know, how you started out.
Yeah.
And if he's starting it out just
personality thing,
being, people, and you can start it out as fuel. If you just want to like stick a power bar in your mouth and go about your business, that's a story to be told. But the fact that he, you know, sort of actively opposes breakfast.
Weird. Kat, what did you have for breakfast today?
I have
to know you.
Roberta's Pizza.
Okay, awesome.
Which is really great. Some andouille. We got the Speck and Wolf and the original and some olives. And it was the perfect way to start the day.
Excellent. So going into this new administration year, in which I think the media is being very, targeted right now, or a lot of attention is being put on it. Do you think that there's going to be a lot of, what do you expect to see? And maybe specifically in the world of food writing, are we going to see more think pieces about Trump's food habits or something?
Well, what I really want to see is eagle eye on the administration's oversight of the USDA, about regulations. We were doing a trend piece, you know, where you predict the breakfast trends of the next year. It's if you work in food writing, it's the
there's
law.
There's always going to be that. What's hot?
Yeah. Like what's coming up? And, you know, so we were saying, you know, jackfruit and you know, ice cream for breakfast. And my prediction was salmonella. And the thing is, that doesn't even,
so funny.
It doesn't even come out of nowhere. When I started at CNN within my first few months, that was the big story, was, you know, the recall of 500 million eggs, and that was even with pretty good government oversight. You know, he's talked about rolling some of that back if there's even less government oversight. So many more people are going to be sick.
Yeah, I know. He's like down with like even just the basic what's it called, food safety regulations.
Right?
It's
yeah.
just. Wait, more outbreaks? That's okay.
I think we're really going to, you know, I think a lot of food writing is going to be in response to that. And I think a lot, you know, based on personal responsibility and safety, really, because, you know, if your food isn't being looked out for before it gets to you, you're going to have to learn how to handle it in a really safe manner at home.
Yeah. I can get behind that kind of food writing and reading. Mm-hmm. And if there's an in, like a delicious sort of, you know, lifestyle topic that is starting it out, albeit, you know, so be it. Like I'm totally ready for it and welcoming that. So much to talk about. We're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude and be right back.
Chefs and restaurants are proud of the food they put on the table, and serving produce that comes from local, environmentally responsible farms is a way to leave an even better taste in everyone's mouth. So when shopping for your ingredients, look for the New York State Grown and Certified seal. It lets you know which food is grown right here in New York State, certifying the food that comes from local farms that meet a higher standard. You'll not only be serving local food, you'll be supporting local farmers. Learn more about the New York State Grown and Certified program at certified.ny.gov.
All right, we're back chatting more with Kat Kinsman. She is the author of the new memoir, High Anxiety. And Kat, you are such a successful and established food writer and editor. And I'm curious, we were talking a little bit off air about how you seem to have a dual career also talking about mental health. How do you think those two paths bridge, or do they, in your line of work?
Well, the way that that's played out is I am really open about this. And even before the book came out, mm-hmm. I wrote a lot about it. So what started happening was I would be interviewing a chef who was doing a demo, whether it was at, you know, CNN or Tasting Table or wherever I was working. And we would go off air for a minute, stop recording, and they would say, like, look, can I talk to you for a second? And they would talk about their own depression, their own anxiety, or that of somebody who worked in their restaurant.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, so pervasive and happens, you know, once, okay, they trust me, a couple of times, like, okay, they must really trust me. And it started happening more than half of the time. And then the year before last, there were a few high profile deaths in the food community.
I know.
And it got to, almost a year ago, a little bit over a year ago, January 1st or 2nd of 2016, I launched a website called Chefs with Issues to really explore, you know, the issues the mental health issues that people in the restaurant industry are facing. And with that, I launched a survey asking people, you know, what are the issues you face? You know, what kind of care are you getting for them? What are the attitudes from the people who you work with? And I thought I would get a few dozen responses, maybe a couple hundred if I was lucky. And last I looked in, I had over 1,600 responses. And it's really, there's a very, very clear pattern about what is happening.
There's a strong need, to have more discussion around this topic, which, you know, it's really sad when you see something just sort of hit a wall and, you know, a brilliant career sort of come to an end. It's time to, like, start talking about the why, but also just start talking and put it out in the open.
Yeah, and I've been fortunate enough over the course of the past year to really be able to, you know, I went to Mad Symposium and talked about it in Copenhagen there. I was able to speak at Cherry Bomb. And, you know, in addition to the survey, people could answer it and then they could fill in tick-in boxes and things, but then I left an area at the end where they can write in whatever they wanted to, just get it off their chest. They could do it anonymously or not anonymously. I work with a group also called the Heirloom Foundation based out of Charleston, and they get together grants for the families of chefs who are going through crisis. And I said, okay, you need some anecdotal evidence. I went through that column. I thought, oh, I'll take a minute and I'll go through and I'll redact any personal information just to make sure. Yeah. 26,000 words later, I had a document to send them with just stories that people told me about what they were facing in their restaurants. And it is real, it is pervasive, and it's about to get worse if people suddenly, the few people who have health care are stripped of it.
Yeah.
It's about to get really, really dire.
Do you think that the food industry is particularly fraught for exhaustion, stress, and a lack of benefits?
Yeah, people don't have the money. They don't have the health care. It's, you know, a brutal and demanding career, and you know, let's say you're getting
off. Fragile too to like open a restaurant.
People don't have any money. I mean, the profit margins are so completely tight, and you know, and we're looking at, you know, celebrity chefs is one thing, but then you have, you know, you go to your sous chef, you go to your line cook, your dishwasher, your porter, your server, who don't have the resources, and then what do you see that's in front of you? Oh, hey, here's my shift drink. Mm-hmm. Here's us getting off at 2 a.m. We're wired. Let's go and get another drink. I want to stay out. I want to take this bump of whatever is being offered to me. And then it's hard to wake up the next day. It really feeds itself. And it's also a profession that's really, really great for a lot of people who maybe can't have a traditional career, that, you know, they find a family in the restaurant kitchen, and the order and repetition is so great for them. And it's a really fantastic thing. But then you also, you know, find a community where, you know, it's a chicken egg sort of thing. People with certain vulnerabilities are drawn to the profession, but then maybe some of things are exacerbated because of it. Mm-hmm. But what I'm finding, more and more people are willing to talk about it, and I think a lot of people are starting to break the cycle.
Yeah, no, that's great. And what do you think about being a writer, particularly a food writer? Because you have a wonderfully triumphant sort of passage in here where you describe having to go through, you know, facing up to trolls and other sorts of criticism, you know, seeing the Amazon.com reviews, which are kind of, you know, you never know what you're going to get out there in response to a story, for instance. I love, if you don't mind, could I read?
Oh, yeah, please.
You write, here's the thing. The higher up you climb, the harder it is to hide. When you screw up in the big gig, or someone thinks you did, it's in high definition, broadcast on millions of TVs and computer monitors across the globe, and people won't hesitate to tell you all about it. So, you know, you go about talking about how, you know, you have to expect blowback, maybe even death threats. And you write, it means people are paying attention and taking what you say seriously. It means I'm doing my job. Once I took the leap and someone decided to pay me to be a full-time writer and editor, it was the very worst thing I could do. The very worst thing I could do was to be afraid of having a strong opinion. Do your homework, back it up with facts when you can, and you're bulletproof. That was my game. I think that that's a really strong message to any kind of aspiring writer out there, because, you know, you're going to face, especially in this digital, you know, media age, you're going to face blowback for just the benignest things, too, sometimes.
Oh, for being a woman sometimes.
Right.
I remember one comment in particular. I remember I'd gone on CNN. I was doing a segment about, you know, health alert systems when there are, you know, outbreaks in, you know, in restaurant kitchens or something. And somebody tweeted at me to let me know he had to stop his masturbation session because my face came on his TV and upset him enough. And I was like, wait, you were watching Sanjay Gupta's show during that anyway? Mm-hmm. Like, that was your plan, sir? Mm-hmm, and the thing is completely unrelated to the quality of what I did. But if you are a person in the public eye, especially if you're a woman, it has nothing to do with how good your work is. And the sooner you realize that, the better. Yeah. I had given, I think, a good informative segment on this show, and that was his takeaway from it, and there was nothing I could do about it.
Yeah. But on the other hand, like, I love that you you still take on those challenges. You picked a fight with Anthony Bourdain. You criticized Paula Deen. I know, it ended up being great, but also, you know, you can't, watering down your opinion is not the solution here. You can't make everyone happy.
Especially not right now. You know, we're all going to have a lot to look back on in a few years. And I think if we're not all in a position where we thought, you know, we did the best we possibly could, you know, then I don't know. I don't want to get to a place in my life where I regret not having, you know, taken the shot, having said what I believe in. There are a whole lot of things to be afraid of, you mm-hmm. know, and mm-hmm. some of them are more real than others, but it's been a real struggle to me to get to a place where I don't let fear completely rule my life. But yeah. I've realized, like, regret is a far more painful thing yeah. than, you know, regret at not having done something would be far more painful than, you know, having stood up for something I believe in.
Speaking of which, I mean, I think that it's a real testament in itself that you are a very busy, you know, very successful writer, and yet you talk about, you know, having these fears throughout this book, and including the opening passage where you're running to make a flight, and you get caught up looking for your ring or something like that, and, you know, it was funny, but it was also like it made my heart pound, and I was like, oh my god. So, you know, you're reading this, and I think that the triumphant message is that you can overcome that. You didn't not go on that flight, you know, for instance.
Yeah, I think the best thing we can do is allow each other humanity. Whoever you're looking at, you know, if they're out in public, even if it's somebody on the same train as you, like, they had to, you don't know what anybody had to go through to get out of the house that day. Yeah, and true. I think that's what's really opened it up to me, that when I'm very public in there about, you know, I have a sort of mild agoraphobia sometimes where it really is hard to just leave my house. And I can go and do things like go and speak in front of hundreds of people or be on live TV, and nobody mm-hmm. would suspect that it was really, really hard for me just to get out my front door that day. And I think the fact of saying that allows other people to realize, oh wow, you know, I'm going through the same thing. I'm not alone.
Right.
You know, I can get through that as well. I think if we allow each other that little bit of humanity, that goes, it doesn't cost you any. Being mm-hmm. being kind to somebody doesn't cost you anything. No. It only adds to your own humanity. So why not, you know, take a chance and do that?
That's a great point. That's really, really nice. And I think that everyone will pick up on that from reading this book and just enter their days with a little bit more of a smile, hopefully. One thing I wanted to note that I really enjoyed looking through this book is that you have these little vignettes, I guess, about, so, you know, it's a memoir, it follows your life, you know, from childhood and so forth to your career, but interspersed are these fun little vignettes, or whatever you want to call them, about irrational fears. And no, I've heard of the elevator one. I've heard of, you know, I don't know, being in a crowded subway car. But you have ones that are hilarious. Irrational fear number 8, for example, picking things up.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. It's a thing. I actually will say it right now. I dropped a ring off for repair that my husband had given me.
What is with that?
it's entirely rational, but it's one of the things that most people like, that more people than any of these other fears have said uh-huh. that they have too.
Really?
You drop something off to be fixed or something like that, and you're afraid to go pick it up because you're afraid it's going to be gone. So you just let it go and go and go and go.
Oh,
so yeah, so this ring that we're finally picking up. My husband mm-hmm. had given me a year ago, we dropped it off a year ago tomorrow, and picking it up. I guess I kept thinking, like, oh, it's been a little time. Oh my gosh, they probably threw it away. Oh my gosh. And the longer I go without like confirmation of the fact that they threw it away,
uh-huh, you know,
it is entirely irrational. I own this. It's
right.
But really, so many people, and especially like in the chapter, I talk about my car being towed and mm-hmm. then being afraid to go and pick it up. So many people have come up to me and said, oh my God, you don't know how many thousands of dollars Ooh. I've spent getting my car back or waiting to get my car back or whatever and just letting it sit there. It's weird.
Hey, let's talk more about these irrational fears and then maybe we'll not do them or not follow them. I love this one, getting my hair cut.
Oh, yeah.
I can understand that, you know. Somebody's touching your hair. It's a little personal space issue. But also, what if they chop off, you know, some weird section?
Yeah, and it's the social interaction of it, too. It's like, it's the small talk. The last time I did get my hair professionally cut, I did, in fact, get a whole foot, or maybe even, like, foot and a half. I have really, really long hair. It's always in a bun on top of my
mm-hmm,
head.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman behind me screamed. And I was thinking, it's my hair, not yours. But it's
bizarre.
Yeah, it's really really strange. And it's sort of like a, you know, getting the appointment on time, like, oh my gosh, the tip, how do I do that? And do I have to make small talk? And then what if they think I'm going to look horrible? It's such a ridiculous thing that's one of those things too. So I have really long hair. I cut my bangs myself. I cut them this morning. Mm-hmm. And it's just one of those things where it's actually kind of powerful. I found out for other people to say like, oh my God, me too.
It makes me laugh too. Instead of like worry about these things anymore, I laugh because somebody is talking about them and then we're realizing how ridiculous it is.
Oh yeah. It's like once you like shine a light on any of these things, you're like, oh my gosh, that's so silly. Yeah. You know, that's why I call them like, so the title of these is Irrational Fears.
It's very self-knowing. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. So like being a passenger in a car, sometimes being a driver of a car, you know, it's these little things and you feel, and that's one of the things about anxiety that's so isolating because you think like nobody would understand if they knew that I was afraid of this little thing. And then it turns out like other people have it too. Oh my gosh, I'm not just a total freak. It's really empowering.
I don't know. I think this is a really fun book. And I'm so glad you came to talk about this in between, you know, going to a conference soon. So I'm glad we could catch you, Kat. But I guess that's about all the time we have for today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This is great. Yeah. And the pizza was fantastic.
Awesome. Always a specialty here at Heritage. All right. Well, everyone check out High Anxiety, Life with a Bad Case of Nerves. And thanks again, Kat.
Thank you.
We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Oh, I like the way you do.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.